Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. This summer, I've been running an occasional series of interviews with authors who have written about the question of how to intervene in or respond to mass atrocities. The interview we're about to do isn't really, at least not strictly, part of that series. And yet, in a different kind of way, it's going to focus again on the question of how to respond to a mass atrocity, but from a very different angle. My guest today is Noah Shanker. Noah is the author of the new book, Reframing Holocaust Testimony. The book makes a powerful plea to recognize the importance of institutional procedures and priorities when evaluating Holocaust testimonies. Noah applies his background in memory and media studies to examine three major institutional repositories of Holocaust testimonies. His conclusions challenge us to rethink the way we relate to these testimonies and to testimonies collected from other cases of mass atrocities. It's an impressive work, one which I'm looking forward to discussing. And so, with that, Noah, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us in New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, I always like to give guests a chance to talk a little bit about how they came to be who they are. And so why don't we start? How did you end up deciding to become an academic?
It's an interesting question. When I was a young kid, I grew up in a family of, well, not having any academics per se. My grandfather was a rabbi in the Reform Jewish movement. And every Shabbat or every high holiday service, I remember going to hear him give a sermon on whatever the topic was for that portion of the Torah. But it was always politically tinged. He was someone who was involved with the civil rights movement, someone who was involved with teaching at universities, even though he didn't have a PhD. And I just remember being incredibly moved by his form of speech, from his engagement in politics and in history. And so even though I didn't have any academics growing up, it always seemed to be an example for me. And so I remember when I went to college, I have to keep on reminding myself to not refer to it as university, as I'm speaking to an American audience, and I'm not speaking to my colleagues here in Australia. If I was to say college, they think I'm referring to high school. But when I went to college, the first course I ever took, the two of the most, I think, important classes I ever took were in my freshman year. Not three of the most important classes I ever took were at a small kind of residential college in the University of Michigan, and they had a course called "On Listening to Holocaust Survivors," which was taught by Henry Greenspan, who has written quite extensively in Holocaust testimony. And the other class was a class called Visual Culture in Weimar Germany. And the other class was on psychoanalytic approaches to literature. So even though these were really incredibly intimidating classes for an 18-year-old to be taking, especially the psychoanalytic approaches to literature, into using Lacan to analyze Wuthering Heights is enough to send someone running for the hills. But it gave me at least a first taste for the ways in which, media mattered, the way, whether it was literature or film or testimonies. And I never anticipated going into academia. It was always to be a lawyer or to work in politics or in government, and then eventually in film. And so when I ended up working out of college at a public relations firm and, surprise, surprise, became disenchanted with that world, I worked as a production assistant for some low-budget films and some commercials that were being created and produced in Chicago. And I ended up really enjoying that environment. And so I thought, okay, I'll apply to film school, become a producer. And so I ended up moving to Los Angeles and going to film school at USC. In Los Angeles, moving there, not knowing a soul, and thinking I would study critical studies, which was the history and theory aspect of the school, not the production, not the screenwriting or directing portion of the school. And just because I wanted to make this network of people who I could then, foster a sense of community and work in production there. And in the course of taking these classes on critical studies, reading theory and reading the history of film and media, really became enthralled with it and I never looked back. And so just the idea that one could become an academic in film and media studies was something that was completely foreign to me, and I fell in love with it pretty quickly.
And so now you identify yourself in part as somebody who does memory studies. How did that transition happen?
Well, I mean, initially I thought I was going to be a film scholar because I had, had gone to USC where the names of Spielberg and Lucas are on every building in the film school, and Zemeckis and Howard and those names. And I initially wanted to write about the ways in which filmmakers like Spielberg with Schindler's List were representing the Holocaust. I became interested in the history of Holocaust representation as a potential area for a dissertation topic. It was between that or the films of Joel Schumacher I decided to, I could have been mining the depths of St. Elmo's Fire, my argument that he's the new, Vincente Minnelli. But in the end, I thought perhaps Spielberg was a more viable option. And but in that time, in a methods class I was taking, the Professor Tara McPherson took us to the backlot of Universal Studios in Studio City, just over the hills from LA, to look at this project that had started not long ago to collect testimonies of Holocaust survivors. And it was the Spielberg project, which was at the time the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History. It had this very long kind of unmanageable title at that point. It would just refer to it as the Shoah Foundation, but the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History project at that point. And I became really interested in the work that they were doing and some of the ways in which Spielberg as a filmmaker and the particular sets of tropes, or that is to say kind of representational strategies that he would use in film were then spilling over into this testimony process. And that became really not only a question of film, but issues of testimony, which are inevitably, needless to say, issues of memory. And so my entry into memory studies came through testimony, through my first encounter with the Shoah Foundation testimonies there. And then as my work progressed and working with advisors at the time at USC like Marita Sterkin, and then having the great fortune of working with Janet Walker at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who became a member of my committee, the work that I was doing ended up going in the direction of memory and trauma, and I was very, really, really fortunate to be working with scholars who were expert in those areas. And it just seemed as if you're going to do work on testimony, you can't do that without engaging the work of memory, engaging the work of trauma. So that's how I got into memory studies, and I've never left.
So let's turn to the book. And there's some just two or three terms that you use throughout the book that I thought I'd ask you just to talk about and define briefly. The first is testimonial literacy. What do you mean by that, and why is it so important?
For me, I remember when I was doing a fellowship at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. in 2006 and 2007, and I was doing archival research, just looking at the institutional protocols of the museum and how they were shaping the collection of testimony, as well as the display of testimony. And I was working alongside historians who were really interested in testimony, and also with educators who were really interested in testimony in terms of its content, especially in the part of historians at that time. So I would often hear, though interestingly, in the case of the Holocaust Museum, they did have transcripts for many of the testimonies recorded there. I would often hear something along the lines of, if only we had the full transcript. As if the reading of the transcript of a testimony constitutes the content, constitutes the textuality of testimony. And for me, I'm someone who believes in duration and in the process of a close reading and a close looking and a close listening, and all the various sensory engagements that we have to bring with testimony. And that means being attuned to the silences. That means being attuned to what's happening on camera, the ways in which the subject, that is the witness, is framed by the camera, whether it's a medium close-up or an intense close-up or a long shot. Are there gestures, or are the tattoos on the left arms of an Auschwitz survivor present on screen? Do they have various ways of accenting or accentuating particular phrases? So when I mean testimonial literacy, it means an eye and an ear for the kinds of performance that a witness will bring to the table. But that also means an eye and an ear for the setup of the camera and the kinds of questions that are being asked. Really reading testimony as a text in its physical ways, in its sense, in its olfactory ways, the ways that smell functions, the way that what's happening off camera influences and is often as important as what's happening on camera. And so that's really the idea of not taking for granted that these testimonies are mediated rather than these raw sources. And I think for a lot of scholars in the kind of the early stages of discussing testimony, talked about testimony either as raw capsules of memory or as works that were to be interpreted or analyzed as literary texts. And I felt that they have their own media specificity. And so what testimonial literacy means is to essentially be attuned to what those specificities are and the way they function and how they shape meaning in a witness's exchange with their interlocutor.
So the second term is post-memory. What does that mean?
Well, post-memory is a term that I can't claim any credit for. That would be a term that I have to attribute to and have attributed to Marianna Hirsch from Columbia University and her work, which has just been incredibly foundational to the field of not only of Holocaust studies, but to memory studies more broadly. And by post-memory, she means lots of things. First, it's reference to this notion, not a notion. I mean, it's the reality that the population of Holocaust survivors is dwindling, that given that Elie Wiesel died just this summer, and the fact that he was this iconic survivor, in many ways he was the quote-unquote survivor, or the survivor. What do we do as that survivor community is dwindling? How will the memory that resides with living survivors be transmitted beyond their living presence through testimonies, through new media, but not only through that, but through graphic novels like Maus, through films like Schindler's List or Shoah, or the films of Peter Forgash or others? So how does that memory get transmitted beyond the living survivor to to second generation, to third generations, to those who have familial connections to the survivor, but also beyond, to those who have no familial connection to the Holocaust, and also to those who have no connection to the Holocaust whatsoever? How do we follow the various paths of memory beyond its living presence? And to realize that it's not a matter, let's say in contrast to this, it's not a matter of transmitting memory as if through a needle into a patient, right? That it's not something that's transmitted raw and unfettered and unmediated, but rather something that is creates or generates the effects in the case of a traumatic memory without claiming to appropriate the trauma of those who had experienced it firsthand. So there's been a lot of, you know, if the New York Times writes about it, it must be a phenomenon, right? Well, so there's a lot of writing about, though I'm not under the belief at all that it's a phenomenon of any, you know, extensive nature, which is this idea that at one point a few years ago, the New York Times wrote a piece of about the children and grandchildren of survivors having tattooed their left arms with the same numbers that their Auschwitz surviving grandparents had inscribed on their arm. There was a film called Numbered, which was about this very phenomena. And though I don't think it's widespread, in fact, on the contrary, I think it's very limited, there are organizations that I've been asked to consult on and I've declined that ask the second and third generation of Holocaust victims, that is to say their children and grandchildren as survivors, to give the testimony of their parents or grandparents as if they were their parents or grandparents. And in places like Hiroshima, you have the creation of these memory docents where victims of Hiroshima are training docents to tell their memories after they're gone. So this is a really concrete issue. And for me and for Marianne Hirsch, it's a question of theorizing that, not as an appropriative thing, but it's something that can actually lead to new knowledge and that ultimately recognizes that there's a difference, right, between the primary victim and those who take on their stories through different representational strategies, through art, through poetry, through literature, through film, and through testimony. But it's not simply something that's transmitted in whole, but rather it's the effects and the questions that are raised by that process and the gaps between an individual who survived firsthand and those who work with and interpret and engage with their stories after the fact. So that's in essence some of the key questions behind post-memory.
And then the last distinction, or the last terms with a distinction, and again, this is one you borrow and use to great effect. What do you mean by common memory and deep memory, and what's the distinction between them?
Yeah, it's a term that originates with Charlotte Delbo, and which then gets picked up by Lawrence Langer, and after that by Charlotte Friedlander, and others who discussed it, such as James Young and others. So it's a term that's widely discussed. The idea being that if we take a Holocaust survivor, and we'll just say an example would be Chaim Engel, who was a survivor of the Camp Sobibor, and who I know we'll be discussing his wife at a later point in the interview. He was discussed in the work of Lawrence Langer. To use an example, if we're talking about Chaim Engel's time in Sobibor, sorting the clothes of the victims, the idea would be the notion of common memory, Chaim giving his testimony at the Fortunoff archive in the mid-1980s. There's Chaim, as he is at that moment, looking back on the events of the 1940s. And there's the Chaim of the 1980s who can look back with somewhat of a safe distance, the distance of time, say, this is what happened then, that there is often at least a clear linear, or if not linear, at least some sort of reconstruction of what happened over a course of time with a series of events. But that, to use a term, or to borrow a term or a phrasing by Shaul Friedlander, when memory comes, in this case when traumatic memory comes, when deep memory comes, it is the collapsing of that kind of temporal I am here, that was then, that was there. It's a collapse of that. It's this notion that deep memory marks the return to the past and an inability. Basically, it is the emergence of the past in the present, or you could look at it the other way, or the return of the past into the present, or traveling back to the past from the present, that it is a moment in which these temporal delineations collapse, where the deep traumatic memory emerges and the survivor finds her or himself back at that moment, and often unable to articulate a clear kind of causal chronology. It's that breakdown in the ability to tell things in a transitive manner. It is, in essence, it is often marked by silence. It's often marked by an inability to communicate or to render into words that are comprehensible that which is incomprehensible. And that's really the challenge that people like Friedlander have raised, is how do we, in the absence of survivors, after survivors have passed, how will you preserve that deep memory, that memory which can't be easily unified, which exists in excess of historical narrative? That is, it can't be said, this happened here, then, and this is the reasons and the causes, right? That it exists outside of that trajectory. And how do we preserve those moments, those moments where the story breaks down, the moment when the individual subject breaks down, potentially, and when their story is in an excess of what is possible to communicate, when it is so traumatic that it can't be rendered adequately into words, that sometimes it registers in ways that are more difficult to read.
So you looked at three different institutions in this book.
Yep.
The Fortunoff Archive, the Holocaust Museum in the U.S., and then the Shoah Foundation.
Yes, correct.
And you identified several, 13, 14, something like that, interviewees who had been interviewed by each one. And so I thought maybe the place to start here is to ask you to talk a little bit about the testimonies of, and you referred to her earlier, of Selma E., and talk a little bit about how those testimonies differed from case to case.
Selma's testimony or testimonies are probably the most powerful testimonies that I've had the privilege of watching. Not that there's a hierarchy, but for whatever reason, they made a lasting impact on me, as did those of her husband, Chaim, who I made reference to earlier. When I first watched, I ended up watching them, I believe, in sequence, so that my first encounter with Selma was in her first testimony that was given at the Fortunoff Archive, which is housed at Yale University, and it was recorded in 1980. So on a research trip, I went to the Fortunoff Archive, and I asked to see the videotape for her testimony. And I looked at her testimony, which was recorded in 1980, and what I remember was just the rawness and the immediacy, is, even though I'm hesitant to use words like raw and immediacy after I just talked about the ways in which testimony is mediated, there was something incredibly powerful about her. A, because the camera was a bit more free-flowing, as I recall, and my memory might be misguided in this respect, but there was she had, at this point, it had been 35 years after liberation, or over 35 years after liberation, and so she still has this physical presence that's incredibly strong, and she has the agency, and she takes upon herself this agency to communicate with the kind of directness and a strength that is really noticeable. And she's talking about things that are a very unique historical nature, given that she's a survivor of Sobibor, having taken part in the uprising there, and having successfully escaped. As you know, very few people actually successfully survived the escape from the Sobibor death camp. And there's just an urgency in the way that she spoke, and an eloquence in the way that she spoke, and the ways in which she was able to reflect not only on what she had experienced, but how, in the moment of 1980, and this is really important, she was given the space and took the space in 1980 to reflect on the ways in which that memory, as she was recalling it in 1980, impacted her at the moment of its telling. It wasn't simply about conveying the details of the past. It was also about the ways in which that past was very much alive in her present moment. Mm-hmm. And that was really palatable. So when I went to go look at her testimony at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and that was recorded in 1990, so this is 10 years after her initial testimony at the Fortunoff Archive, I noticed that that urgency, while still there, and the urgency was never lost with her. I've never had the privilege of meeting Selma in person. But there's an insistence there, a strength and determination there that comes throughout all of her testimonies. But at the second testimony that she gave in sequence, this is 10 years after the first Fortunoff Archive, she gives one at the Holocaust Museum in 1990, there's something a bit more constrained about her, not about her herself, but by the nature of the interview. She talks a great deal about and is asked a great deal about the nature of the uprising at Sobibor, the details about how she first met Chaim there, her husband, who would then become her husband, details about the escape from Sobibor. She spent a great deal of the interview talking about the content of the past and less about the ways in which that past continues or continued at that point to resonate with her psychically. And so that was really noticeable. By the time I looked at her testimonies to the Shoah Foundation, I discovered by sheer accident, and as we know, doing archival work is a series of happy accidents, and I noticed that she'd given not one but two testimonies at the Holocaust Museum, one in 1995 and at a later point in 1998. There was no firm explanation that was given to me for that, though I later learned after the fact some of the reasoning for it, which was the first one was so terrible, so ridden with questions on the part of the interviewer that Selma was not allowed any space whatsoever to get into the rhythm of the testimony or to be left to give any agency in discussing what had happened to her. But what was interesting was that two things came out of that interview and the subsequent interview in 1998, which never came up in the interviews prior, that is to say in the Fortunoff Archive and in the Holocaust Museum, which is, even though she had mentioned in both of those earlier two testimonies that she had traveled to Holland after living in Poland, and on the way on a boat stopping over in Odessa, that her and Chaim had a young son and that the young son died. And there was reference made to that in 1980. There was reference made to that in 1990. And while there was reference to that, the name of the child was never mentioned. And it's not until 1995 that any mention of the child is brought into the conversation, and that's brought into the conversation by the interviewer. And it's only in that interview in 1995 that we also learn that Selma was a victim of sexual assault. At no other point in any of the earlier testimonies that were taken in 1980 nor 1990 do we learn that. And these two events, the loss of her son, who we learn was named Emil, and her sexual assault while in Holland, her family owned a hotel, those are foundational events, and events that she had not been given the space or perhaps had not felt comfortable to articulate at the earlier stages of her earlier testimonies. But they come out much later. I think that says a lot about the passage of time, but I also think it says a lot about the methodologies of the respective institutions which collected her testimony.
Well, let's look at those institutions, and let's start with the Fortunoff Archive. And I think we've got maybe 5-6 minutes for each one of these individual cases. So I know that we'll miss a lot of detail, and I encourage listeners to go read the book. It has a lot of really fascinating stuff in it. But with the Fortunoff Archive, so where did this come from?
Well, the Fortunoff Archive came it emerged really as a grassroots effort. It emerged out of New Haven, Connecticut, the Jewish community of New Haven. It emerged as really as a response in large part to what many in that Jewish community, and frankly, what many in the Jewish community nationwide, if not on a, you know, at a global scale, found as a to be plighted disenchantment with the popularization of Holocaust memory, particularly through the miniseries Holocaust that came out in the late 1970s. Many in the New Haven Jewish community felt that that film had trivialized the experiences of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel had written a piece, you know, harshly critiquing that that film, that miniseries. And it was a time of mobilization in survivor communities in the United States. Having grown up not far from Skokie, Illinois, having gone to Jewish day school in Skokie, Illinois, which used to house the largest per capita survivor community outside of Israel, until somewhat recently supplanted by my current home in Melbourne, Australia. You know, survivor activism was in the 1970s really on a rise, and to whether it was in the form of trying and successfully stopping the march of neo-Nazis on Skokie, and having successfully lobbied President Jimmy Carter for the mandate for the creation of a Holocaust museum, which was successful in the 1970s. And then I think this film, or I should say this miniseries on NBC, Holocaust, the miniseries, really was an important turning point for trying to counter that trivialization of Holocaust memory through the creation of something that was more grassroots, but also much more attuned to the truth and experiences, and to the respect and sanctity of Holocaust survivors. And so the Shoah, the Portnoy Archive emerged out of the work of the psychoanalyst and child survivor Dori Laub, and the television producer Laurel Block, who, based out of New Haven, created what would then later become the Portnoy Archive. And that archive was from the outset, and with the later work of Jeffrey Hartman, who recently passed away, who was a survivor of the Kindertransport and a faculty member at Yale, and then later on through the work of Lawrence Langer as an interviewer. But even from the onset, the focus was always on making sure that the survivor and the agency of survivors was first and foremost, that survivors would be given the leeway to drive the testimony process, that as much respect and as much latitude was given to them. Not, and by respect, I don't mean not that they wouldn't be engaged critically. On the contrary, critical engagement was at the heart of that enterprise and remains to be at the heart of that enterprise. But rather that, contrary to imposing a rigid census-like series of questions and an extensive pre-interview process that would, in essence, deem a testimony redundant, the focus was on allowing the survivor the space to drive the drive the interview as much as possible. And that meant being respectful to the silences, being attuned to the silences, to use Dori Laub's term, to be a co-owner in the process of testimony, to realize that you are sharing, in essence, a special contract with the witness, and that there's a special set of obligations which are ethical in nature, which means also recognition that you are not the survivor and that you are not experiencing their trauma, but you are still responsible for helping them facilitate an expression of that trauma. And it's not about psychoanalysis. This is not an analytical environment. This is a testimonial environment, but it's still one that is geared and influenced by a respect for the traumas that had been experienced by the witness, and making sure that the witness is the one who is really guiding or driving the process rather than the interviewer driving the process. So rather than starting a question or an interview with a question such as, please give me your name, where were you born, what was the town like in which you were born, you will have a question often along the lines of, there is a picture of the past. Paint me that picture. And I'm paraphrasing, but there are questions yeah. such as that. If your memory is a picture book, what is the first picture that you see? Something that is more evocative of along those lines, something that also generates questions that are geared towards the process of telling the testimony as well as about the content of that testimony. So that was always an essential part of that process. And because it's an academic institution in which it's housed, you have to go to the office or the Department of Special Collections to look at testimonies. It wasn't until the Portsmouth Archive recently digitized their testimonies and are making them available outside of the Sterling Library. For most of its history, you had to go and travel to New Haven. There was no online access. There were no videotapes being sent to you in the mail. You had to go there, and it meant putting in the time and the labor to identify the testimony and to really do the work in advance of preparing for that encounter. And so even the mode in which that testimony was made available to involved work and involved a sense of responsibility, involved a sense of having to carry a great deal with you into that process, even as a viewer of the testimony. And so there was a great deal, I think, placed on the sanctity of the survivor's experience. And that's also reflected in the fact that in the Holocaust Museum, and I'm not compromising her identity in the sense that Selma Engel is Selma Engel in the Holocaust Museum and is Selma Engel in the Shoah Foundation, yeah. but she is Selma E. Mm-hmm. in the Fortunoff Archive. So using the first name and last initials to protect the identity of the survivor.
So the Holocaust Museum has a very different mission. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what Congress established for the mission as the mission of the Holocaust Museum and how that came to be embodied most in the permanent exhibition, which you call the soul of the, or that's not fair. You quote one of the leaders of the initial founding of the museum is saying is the soul of the museum.
Yeah, I mean, the mandate for the museum was to be a living memorial to the Holocaust, but also as part of that mandate included part of the planning, and I spent really just months combing through the various institutional archives, was to also create what initially was called the Committee Conscious, which was to ostensibly raise awareness of other conflicts, potentially other genocides that were happening in the world after the Holocaust. So even from the outset, there was a mission to commemorate and preserve the memory of the Holocaust on one hand, but also to draw attention to any potential genocides that would take place after the establishment of the museum. So the permanent exhibition, or the PE, has changed very little over the past since its opening in 1993. The permanent exhibition that traverses the floors of the Holocaust Museum was intended to have a core narrative structure, a three-act structure, in essence. What was life like briefly leading up to the rise of Nazis to power before the Holocaust? Then there is the Holocaust era, and then there is liberation and life after the Holocaust. And so that three-act structure, which is instrumental to many of the testimonies that I'm looking at, including the Shoah Foundation testimonies, was also central to the creation of the permanent exhibition at the Holocaust Museum. The idea, and it was a contentious idea from the beginning, was, well, who will be the central victims in this story? What about the Romani people, the Roma and the Sinti? And that became a contested issue into which victim group would be given more or less representation. Ultimately, it is a permanent exhibition that is focused on Jewish victims of Nazism. And though there have been related temporary exhibits, the permanent exhibition is at its core about the Jewish experience of the Holocaust. And when they refer to the soul or the permanent exhibition as the soul of the museum, there was the sense that they had to enshrine not simply through artifacts, but also through a narrative strategy, through interactive learning, through photographs, through as many different objects as they could collect or get on loan from places like Majdanek or places from Auschwitz and other places, that they could give you an experientially impactful experience. They didn't want it to be, quote, a cold museum. They wanted it to be a hot museum, something that would get the blood flowing on the part of the patrons, that would move patrons on an emotional level. And so at the heart of the Holocaust Museum was this challenge of trying to balance the effective with the analytical demands of representing the Holocaust. And it was something that was labored over, because if we have museum mandate established in the 1970s and it doesn't open until 1993, a great deal of time passes where the content committee and other committees that were part of the commission were really debating vigorously. I mean, just to give you one anecdote that's been also chronicled in the work of Edward Lindenthal, Preserving Memory, which is a fantastic book, whether or not to include hair which was taken from women prior to their processing at Auschwitz. The hair was given to the museum. That museum debated as to whether or not they should put it on display. Ultimately, it was decided that for various reasons, including the fact that one of the members of the content committee, who was a survivor herself, felt that it was disrespectful, that it was counter to religious tradition, and that what if the hair of her mother was in that pile of hair? And so ultimately they took a photo of the hair, and that photo, a mural of that hair is on display, a photo mural of that hair is on display in the museum, but not the hair itself, which was initially put into storage and is no longer actually with the museum. So those kinds of debates about what constitutes, how far should the museum go in tapping into the emotive, effective aspects of the Holocaust experience, and what are the barriers in this, and in some instances, quite literally, what are the barriers? So placing barriers, visual barriers, so that young visitors to the museum or more sensitive viewers to the museum do not have to go through instituting literal barriers for younger visitors to the museum or for older visitors to the museum who might have certain sensitivities about graphic images. So the idea of barriers, literal barriers, figurative barriers that happen in terms of discussions in committee meetings about what should and should not be shown are really instrumental to that debate. So even though it's emphasis on being the soul, that soul is one that has to be regulated, one that's calibrated by the planners in a very, very detailed way.
So then how do audio testimonies fit into how does the youth museum end up seeing as at least part of their mission to amass a significant body of testimonies, and how do they imagine using those?
Well, part of the initial drive for them collecting testimonies in the first place was to have content because in the early stages, when they were still trying to envision how the museum would unfold, part of that included the potential for using testimonies at different aspects of the permanent exhibition. And though there are audio testimonies that are used within the exhibition space, and at the end, the very end of the very conclusion of the permanent exhibition, there is a film which uses first-person testimony of survivors. They initially debated a lot of different alternatives, one of which was, and this was one of the more fascinating ideas, was to use testimonies that they would collect with survivors and to create a computer program that would randomly project 2 to 3 minute long segments of testimonies just at random, so that patrons could get a sense of the mosaic quality, the ephemeral quality as well of the testimonies. Ultimately, what they chose to do was to reshoot, that is, which is an unfortunate use of term, but certain survivors who had given testimony at the archive of the Holocaust Museum, and they refilmed them using less austere backgrounds, filming them in their homes, and they used it for what then became the Testimony Amphitheater. So initially it was to create content for the museum. And then in the 1990s, when Joan Ringelheim took over the process, it was more about giving survivors an opportunity to document their stories, to give their testimonies to an interviewer. So it initially was for museum content, and then it evolved really into more of a testimonial archive along the lines of the Fortunoff Archive, in that respect. So that was initially the drive, a drive towards content, a drive towards curating testimony, and that's still something that they're struggling with. Right now they have an installation of, we can discuss this at a later point if you'd like, which is kind of constitutes the future of Holocaust testimony, so to speak, which is they have it's not quite holographic, but it uses holographic effects to render, and this is based on technology that the Shoah Foundation has developed in concert with the Institute for Creative Technology, which is an artificial intelligence-driven virtual survivor, which is based on having captured a survivor using over 2,000 questions and allowing museum patrons, in this case in the Holocaust Museum, where Pincus is currently on display, and for you to interact with him, ask him questions. So there's always been the idea that, and this is even from the onset before this quote-unquote holographic testimony came into being, was using them interactively for educational programming in the Wexler Learning Center, which is just outside of the permanent exhibition. So there's always an educational imperative, there's a curatorial imperative, but it wasn't initially a testimonial one. It wasn't about collecting an archive of testimonies. It evolved into that, but that was over quite a bit of time.
So then how did that shape their strategies in terms and procedures in terms of interviewing
to give you a perfect example, you know, in the sense that I'm not sure if you're going to, unless you want to talk about Selma at a later point.
I'm happy to return to her now. Yeah.
Well, Selma was, as I mentioned, a survivor of the Sobibor camp and of the uprising, and her testimony that was given in 1990 is a perfect example, I think, of the priorities of the Holocaust Museum at that point. Mm-hmm. At that point, it was directed by Linda Kuzmak. She was the head of the Oral History Department. And it was really about making sure that content, certain historical episodes were captured and that they could be used to illustrate or provide illustration for aspects of the permanent exhibition or perhaps for educational modules. And so one of the most powerful moments in Selma's testimony, one of the most disturbing aspects really in her testimony, is at the end. Now, they had a policy, they being the Holocaust Museum, of only giving 2 hours to interviewees. So that's two tapes. And they were at the end of the second tape and the end of the tape for Selma. And at that point, they're asking Selma a series of questions about having moved to Israel eventually. But at no point up to this juncture in the interview had they asked her about what happened to her after the war with her son, what happened to her with the death of who we will later learn is Emil. And as they're running out of time, you can see the look of concern and anxiety and anger on Selma's part. But they haven't gotten to those questions. And the interviewer, who is conferring with the producer on a headset, is debating, and you can hear this because they think the camera has stopped running, but it is in fact still running. And you hear them debating whether or not they're going to do another tape. And they decide ultimately not to. But as the camera is still running on that remaining tape, you hear Selma say, well, that's very interesting because I lost my son. And then you see her arguing with the interviewer about what you didn't know, that there was time was running out. In other words, they had, in the course of the interview, gotten to the predetermined area of focus, which was the Sobibor experience. They had mined that area. And so there was no need, as far as they were concerned at that juncture in the oral history department, to look at what her life was like after Sobibor. And yet, if you look at the transcript for that interview, the conversation that takes place between Selma, in which she expresses her anger and disappointment in this discussion of her son, is rendered only as technical conversation. In fact, there is a term called technical conversation. So you don't actually hear, none of that is transcribed. You have to look at the testimony to see what emerges at the very end, all the way to the fade to black, where the most important part of the testimony, at least as Selma articulates it, the loss of her son, is not given the space for exploration. And the camera cuts out just as she begins to talk about that. And that just happens to be at the margins. It's only because I kept watching. It wasn't on the transcript. As far as the transcript was concerned, that was technical conversation. And yet, that which the institution deemed to be central, which is to say Sobibor, was in fact much more peripheral relative to the experience of the loss of her son Emil after the war. So the idea that an institution would impose a certain focus on a historical event or on having clear beginnings, middle, and endings, those kinds of preferences have costs. And in this case, they come at the cost of a story that is very central, an experience that is very central to Selma, and it's left at the margins. It's still articulated, it can still be found, and that's precisely why you need to have the testimonial literacy to be able to know to look beyond the transcript, to know that even when it seems that the testimony is coming to a close, just as it seems like it might fade to black, something important might flicker across the screen.
So there's one institution left, and that's the Shoah Foundation. And I'm really, as I was reading this, I was reminded of a class I taught last spring, which titled Holocaust and Its Legacies, and we assigned Schindler's List. And for the first time that I can remember, no one in my class had seen it.
Mm. I'd be curious. And so, have they all seen Inglourious Basterds? So.
Many of them had, yes. But of course, they're all, well, you know, way too young to have been of the age to see it when it came out. And it's now old enough that this is not something they see routinely. So maybe you can say something about how the Shoah Foundation emerged and how that impacted its goals.
No, just on a side note, I've noticed I teach a course on film and the Holocaust, and I ask my students to raise their hand if they've seen Schindler's List, and very few have. And if they've seen a film about the Holocaust, most likely it's Inglourious Basterds. And even then, that's probably a bridge too far for them. But how did the Shoah Foundation start? It started in the direct aftermath of the production, or really emerged out of the production of Schindler's List in Krakow, where Steven Spielberg and his producer, Brunko Lustig, who is himself a survivor of many camps, and just a really singular figure I had the privilege of meeting, Brunko Lustig and Steven Spielberg were approached by Jews from the community of Krakow, who, and others, survivors from other communities, about documenting their stories and testimonies. And the story goes, and I don't know whether this is myth or truth, because this was what Brunko Lustig told me, was that on the plane back, they had a debate about creating the what would then become the Shoah Foundation and trying to determine how many testimonies that they would record. And Brunko Lustig recalled to me that 50,000 seemed like a reasonable figure given the budget that would be required. With that goal in mind, the foundation started in the backlot of Universal Studios in a series of temporary structures and trailers. And eventually migrated over to, conveniently, to the campus of USC, where it became a part of the Division of Humanities. Just as I was starting to do my archival research, it conveniently decided to spare me the trip of driving to Studio City. So that was good. And it became the largest archive of testimony of any kind in the world, and still is, recording over 50,000 testimonies. And its subsequent, you know, move to Rwanda and Guatemala and to documenting other genocides in other locations. But it was, from the outset, a very Spielbergian project, one in which Spielberg, as a filmmaker, was really not less through his money than through his prestige driving the process. And in many ways, also as a classic Hollywood filmmaker in many ways, who's invested in the 3-act structure, that structure bled its way into the structure of the testimony collection. So unlike the Fortunoff Archive, and to a large extent like the Holocaust Museum, it has an extensive, over 40 pages of a pre-interview questionnaire, which is conducted over the phone, filled out over the phone between the interviewer and the interviewee. So there's an extensive pre-interview process. There's an extensive process of asking the witness questions ahead of time, and also of using that pre-interview questionnaire as the index by which they will catalog and index a survivor's testimony. So these testimonies were all digitized, and they're available through a subscriber-based interface. But the notion was that you'd be able to hyperlink, and you can, across different portions of the testimony based on that index. But the priority was given to the written pre-interview questionnaire, which was done before the testimony, so that if any aspect of the testimony contradicted that which was recorded on paper prior, that which was recorded on paper would serve as the basis for the index. So it was very much about establishing a clear what, when, and where, almost a census-like litany of questions about name at birth, spelling of the name, the town in which you live, what was the Jewish community like of that town, where were certain things located, very much about establishing and pinpointing data. And that's not to say that they're not rich testimonies. They're incredibly rich for many reasons. But just to differentiate in its methodology, this was one in which the interviewer, in stark contrast to the Fortunoff Archive, tended to drive the process a great deal more than the interviewee. This was less about the agency of the witness and more about the agenda of the institution. That doesn't mean that survivors, in many cases, survivors are able to transcend that agenda, but it was a much more interventionist approach to testimony, whereby the interviewer wanted to get clear examples of what happened to you, what is your firsthand knowledge of this, what did you see? In essence, using the testimonies to illustrate a pre-existing, pre-established historical record, more as exemplars, as illustrators of a history, rather than witnesses who would generate new knowledge.
Coming back to Selma E., then maybe you can say something about how that impacted her testimony and the way you read her three, or watch and interpret and understand the three testimonies put together.
Yeah, I know. And just to reiterate, I mean, there actually were four testimonies precisely because because the third testimony that she gave at the Holocaust Museum was so interventionist, was so littered with questions that they had to redo it 3 years later. The testimony that she gives especially the initial one in 1995 at the Shoah Foundation, is less equipped to deal with surprises, with spontaneity, with the emergence of what we talked about, which is deep memory. It is a methodology that is geared towards collecting common memory. What happened where, when, who is motivating what action. And so there are moments in Selma's testimony where, to use an example, when she talks about having been sexually assaulted, I have a suspicion that that wasn't even mentioned in the pre-interview questionnaire. And so the surprises that emerge during an interview, something as traumatic as sexual violence, the interviewer didn't know what to do with it. And there's this sense where transitivity takes over, where it says, well, what happened then? Or can we move on into the next portion of the story? It's about keeping things on track. And so this, the testimony with Selma, while she's still the strong, assertive, and indomitable Selma Engel that I had come to know in prior testimonies, at least in her testimonial form, she is curtailed or inhibited by the myriad of questions that are asked of her during that Shoah Foundation interview. And yet, in the final interview that she gives in 1998, and also that Chaim gives, she is joined by her granddaughter and her daughter to discuss, at the end, the inheritances of memory. And this is what is unique and what is, I think, the most valuable part of the Shoah Foundation, is that they cover a lot more material on the, they have a system that wants interviewers to ask questions that will break down the interview into three acts, 40% for pre-war life, 20% for pre-war life, 60% for Holocaust era, and 20% for post-war life. Now that 20%, while still small, is much more significant than any other aspect of post-war life covered or post-Holocaust life covered by the Fortunoff Archive or the Holocaust Museum. It is the only archive of those three to dedicate on a standardized, regular basis time to the post-war era on a consistent basis and on a widespread basis. And it's precisely at that testimony of Selma and Chaim where her daughter Elida and Tegan, her granddaughter, come on screen and have a discussion, in essence, about what we talked about at the beginning of this interview, which is about post-memory, about the inheritances, the legacies of living in the shadow of the Holocaust as a daughter and granddaughter of survivors. And it's one of the most illuminating aspects of a testimony that I've ever watched. And it means that you have to stick around to the end at a moment which you think is going to be filled perhaps with mawkish sentimentality, is actually filled with great insight and great honesty and great openness between three generations. And while I perhaps sound as if I'm being critical of the Shoah Foundation, I'm incredibly in all of the work that they've done in terms of the scale and also the fact that they've given voice to that after the Holocaust, that post-Holocaust life, which is unfortunately missing from a great deal of testimonies. And to have that kind of exchange, the exchange they have between Selma and Chaim and their daughter and granddaughter is incredibly unique. And I wouldn't have been able to find that in any other archive.
So we've taken up a lot of your time, and there's lots of directions I could go kind of to wind this up. And I'm honestly fascinated by this idea you were sketching out earlier of the ways to use modern technology to allow survivors to continue to speak. But let me go a different way, because I suspect many people who listen to this either attend or plan some kind of Holocaust memorial event. And that's a little bit different kind of testimony. Many of these, of course, feature survivors or their children sometimes. So maybe, and I know I'm springing this on you, I wonder what somebody who plans events with centered around survivors can learn from your research.
One of the things you can learn is that no testimony is ever given for the first time, or unless you're at this stage, that it's quite likely that even if it's the act of writing in a diary or the act of telling a friend or someone in the family, that what you're encountering when someone is giving their testimony has been encountered before, and the tendency might be to think that they have a rote approach to that particular performance, and that we not be afraid by the way, to use terms like performance when we talk about Holocaust testimony, that's not a dirty word when it comes to discussing that, that actually there still is this strong ethical responsibility to listen carefully and attend to survivors, and to realize that even if this isn't the first time that they've given this testimony, that there is, for many survivors, that documentary imperative, the imperative to survive. And you'll hear the stories of people and testimonies tell of that drive to survive in order to make sure that these stories are told. And perhaps that's become a cliche, but it's something that resonates with a great deal with a great many survivors and survivor communities, this imperative to tell. And that imperative to make sure that that story is taken with you, and also that it impacts the world outside of the Holocaust. For me, whether or not a survivor is interested in creating some sort of linkage between their story and the story of a survivor of Cambodia or of Rwanda or of Darfur or of Bosnia or Armenia or other genocides, I think those are linkages that are important to make. I think it's difficult for me to conceive of an event to commemorate and memorialize the Holocaust that doesn't also, in some indirect way even, draw our attention without even necessarily naming these other genocides, because it depends on the context of whether that's appropriate, but to, in essence, prick our ethical consciousness, our humanitarian consciousness to the suffering of others. Because ultimately, I think that's what is central to testimony in many respects, is the way in which it forges that contract between an interviewer and an interviewee and the future and anticipated audiences for those testimonies. That it, not that it trains our ethical reflexes, because I'm not sure if that's possible, but at least it serves as a template or as a model for how we might listen and bear witness to the suffering of others. And so if there's a way that we can listen to and engage a Holocaust survivor at an event like the one that you're describing, in a way that, even if indirectly, somehow leads us to ask questions about the world outside of the Holocaust and the world outside of respective communities and outside of the world of that respective event, then I think that's truly productive. And I think that means, whether that's turning to the work of someone like Michael Rothberg, who's written about multidirectional memory, or looking at the work of others like Martha Minow, who look from Harvard Law School, who looked at the ways in which we must kind of have a certain moral consciousness when we look at the Holocaust, but also beyond the Holocaust. I think that there's that need to at least create, if not a direct linkage, at least an underlying ethical linkage that connects us with the suffering of others beyond the Holocaust.
That's a great place to end. It's a great book, Noah, and I heartily recommend it. I have to say, I'm a tiny bit intimidated by the, as a historian, by the time and the energy required to approach the interviews as critically and as thoughtfully as you suggest is necessary. But I think you've made a convincing case for it. And I always end by asking people maybe to suggest something that you were moved by, or you found important, or I don't know if refreshing is the right word, but what book or video or movie or what should I read this weekend or watch this weekend that was important to you while you were doing this research?
For me, there's a Hungarian filmmaker by the name of Peter Forgacs, Forgacs. And he has been given a lot of attention in the documentary film circuit, but not nearly enough attention outside of that circuit. And he's someone who I had the pleasure of studying and also meeting during graduate school at USC. Someone who, not Jewish, a performance artist. Initially, someone who was doing fine arts in Hungary, someone who my mentor, Michael Renoff, has written about at length. And this is a filmmaker who's really interesting because he makes films, at least many of his films are made exclusively using archived found footage. And one film that he made called The Maelstrom is about a Dutch Jewish family. And we see through the home movies that were preserved by one surviving member of the family and which were, you know, given to Peter Forgaard and re-edited and recompiled with music and manipulation of some of the footage brought in. We see the unfolding of the Holocaust from the family lens, so to speak, from the home movies that were collected during, before and during Nazi occupation. And one of the images that stands out, and an image that I will always remember, is a piece of footage which was taken from the home movies of this family, of the family as they were preparing on the night prior to their deportation in their home, sewing the Jewish star in their clothing, making last-minute preparations. And though they didn't know their fate, it's precisely because perhaps they didn't know their fate that there's something about the home movie footage that captures, yes, some of the anxiety, but also the family's warmth and their joy at this moment in history before they knew what history would unfold for them. And the idea that, to go back to what you said, that monuments and memorials and events can serve as forms of testimony, so too can these fragments of home movies, that these traces of traces, these traces of these individuals and their lives, that we not forget the lives that they lived in their homes, that we not only remember their deaths, but also that we remember their lives, and that found footage films that are taken from home movies, such as in the work of Peter Forgaard on his film The Maelstrom, which is admittedly hard to get a hold of, but if you contact the filmmaker Peter Forgaard, I'm sure he'll be more than happy to send you a link to it. It's one of the most powerful films about the Holocaust that I've seen, and perhaps one of the most powerful films of any kind that I've seen. Certainly one of the most singular films. So that would be on my list of films to look at.
I will have to do that. Thank you. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on two main things. One is an article on Raoul Hilberg and the outtakes that were taken. That is to say, the over 200 hours of outtakes that were shot for a film that's 9.5 hours long. So there's been a great deal of research, really rich research, that's been done on Club Ombudsman Shoah, and now that's turning attention to the outtakes, which have been housed and are housed at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So I'm contributing a volume that's on Shoah, and which deals in large part with the outtakes. And so a lot of the key questions that I've taken from my book about what happens that is left off the cutting room, what in essence is left on the cutting room floor, what constitutes the marginalia of a film, I'm looking at now with Hilberg's role as the quote-unquote historian for Landsman Shoah. So that's the project I'm currently completing. And then I've got the project that I'm collaborating with a colleague of mine on, Pinchas Guter, who is a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, who not so long ago was... he gave testimony to the Shoah Archive in the mid to late 1990s, and then a few years ago gave testimony to Stephen Smith, the head of the Shoah Foundation. Over 2,000 questions were asked of Pinchas, and Pinchas was rendered using dozens of cameras into a virtual form and using artificial intelligence. You can go to the Skokie Museum in Skokie, Illinois. You can go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and you can interact with Pinchas in his full... almost, I should say, in his full body form, and ask him questions, and based on this artificial intelligence software, interact, for better and for worse, with Pinchas, asking him a series of questions about his experience. So I'm talking about the implications of quote-unquote holographic testimony, though again, it's not really a holograph, but it emulates kind of the holographic effect. So I'm writing on that as well. So most of my work is looking, and then having just recently published a piece on how a lot of the actual approaches that we talked about over the last hour or so, especially the Shoah Foundation came up with, are now being utilized in places beyond So I published a piece on the ways in which those testimony practices are being used in Cambodia to collect the testimony there. It's also being used in places like Rwanda and places like Guatemala. And so the ways in which these testimonial paradigms migrate from one genocidal context to another, and what are the implications of taking the Shoah Foundation model and applying it to these non-Holocaust case studies, and raises a series of important questions. So those are the three projects that are most current for me.
That's fascinating, and I would love to have you on the show sometime again to talk about some of these things and pursue
those. Thanks, Kai. I really enjoyed talking with you as well. It's really been a great pleasure.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, and take care.
You've been listening to an interview with Noah Shenker about his book, Reframing Holocaust Testimony. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join us next time when we conclude this summer's occasional series of podcasts that address the question of how genocides might be prevented or mitigated, with an interview with Carrie Booth Walling. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.